You're listening to PetLifeRadio.com.
Is your pet stressed out? Does your pet need annual vaccines? Which pet is best for a child? Would you know if your dog was in pain? Pet Life Radio presents The Pet Doctor, where you'll learn everything about keeping your pet healthy and happy. From pet care, pet meds and grooming, to pet food, pet insurance and dental care, this is the place to find out everything there is to know about pet wellness. Whether you have a dog, cat, reptile or rabbit, you'll find answers for your pets straight from the vets, because it's your pet. Health matters. Please welcome your Pet Doctor host, veterinary media consultant and veterinarian, Dr. Bernadine Cruz.
There are times as a veterinarian in Southern California that if it weren't for allergies, I'd be out of a job. A pet can itch, bite, scratch, lick, and chew incessantly to the point that it can inflict severe damage to itself and to a good night's sleep of its owners. Pet owners often seek relief and advice from the pet store's sales staff or Dr. Google, neither of which have degrees in veterinary medicine. Itchy skin in pets and people can be for a myriad of reasons. Determining the cause whenever possible is of paramount importance, not just treating the symptoms. But is it always possible? My guest is Dr. John Plant, and he has the answer. He's a board-certified veterinary dermatologist in Lake Oswego, Oregon. He has some unique insights into what's getting underneath your pet's skin. We'll be right back after this short break.
Please have a seat in the waiting room. The doctor will be with you shortly, right after these messages.
Go to PetcoDeals.com and get $6 off your order of $60 or more and up to 40% off hundreds of items at Petco.
PetcoDeals.com.
But that's not all.
Are you talking to me?
Pet Life Radio listeners, try Audible.com now and get your first 30 days of Audible Listener Gold Membership plan free. And get a free audiobook. Choose from over 100,000 titles. To get this great deal, go to AudibleDeals.com.
That's AudibleDeals.com.
The new Dyson Animal Vacs are powerful bagless upright vacuums for homes with pets. Air muscle and radial root cyclone technology generates the strongest suction power to powerfully remove dust, dirt, and pet hair from the home or car. Go to DysonDeals.com. DysonDeals.com
to order your Dyson Animal Vac today.
Go to PetSmartDeal.com and save up to 30% on awesome gifts for the pets and pet people in your life. Toys, collars, leashes, PetSmart gift cards, treats, and more. Go to PetSmartDeal.com today. PetSmartDeal.com.
Let's talk pets on PetLifeRadio.com. Welcome back to The Pet Doctor on Pet Life Radio with Dr. Bernadine Cruz. The doctor is in and we'll see you now.
Dr. Plant, I know you started your residency down here in Southern California close to me, so you know how bad allergies can be here in Southern California.
That's very true. Many parts of the country will all claim that they have the worst allergies, but from what I've gathered, I think that Southern California is certainly one of the most severely affected areas.
In general, for our listeners, what's an allergy? What causes it?
An allergy is simply an overreaction to something that is normally present and presented to the body and shouldn't be causing an excessive reaction, but in the case of an allergy, it does. And those can be due to environmental things like pollens and mold spores and dust mites, or they can be due to something that's ingested, a food protein source, or even from insects that are injecting small amounts of protein. And by that, I'm talking usually about fleas.
Yes, fleas here in Southern California, even with some of the great flea products that are now on the market, they still seem to be causing issues.
Yeah, they definitely are still one of the, I'd say, top two causes of allergy in dogs and cats as well. And part of that is because it doesn't take very many fleas to really create trouble because they bite so many times a day and they have such a huge population in the environment that sometimes people get a little complacent about their flea control because they're not seeing fleas on their pet, but they're still in the environment.
And I think what a lot of people find amazing, they'll many times bring their pet in going, it has no fleas. And I'll get out my little fine-tooth flea comb, comb it all over, you know, pick up one or two. They're shocked because the usual reply is, well, if there were fleas in the house, I would be chewed on. So, you know, there are no fleas in the house. And gee, there's only one or two, or I treat this pet and, you know, I don't have treat my other pets because they don't have fleas. What's your response to that one?
Well, I talk about the situation where some pets are just not very itchy, even when they have dozens or even hundreds of fleas. Other pets can be extremely itchy with just one flea biting multiple times a day. So it's not a very good, people are not a very good sentinel for knowing whether your house is infested or not. Usually they start biting people after there's quite an infestation in the home.
I'll usually say, okay, if you think there are no fleas, fine. Let me go ahead and babysit for you for a couple of days, keep your pet here in the hospital. You sit on the floor and come back in 3 days and let me know how many flea bites you've gotten, because they'll definitely prefer your pet first. But if there's nothing else around, your legs start looking pretty good for these guys.
Yeah, that's very true.
You were saying that fleas are like one of the top two reasons for pets having that itchy, bitey, scratchies. What's the other one?
The other big cause is atopic dermatitis, or the environmental allergies, and those are the other substances that I was mentioning that are often airborne. Dust mites would be one of the biggest or most common ones, but also pollens and mold spores would be in that category as well. So people often refer to that as allergies. We refer to it as veterinary dermatologists as atopic dermatitis.
What signs would you see on a pet?
So the signs, and that's really what we use to diagnose this. There's no perfect laboratory test for diagnosing it. So really it's the clinical signs and the things that we look for. There's kind of a well-defined list nowadays that we can go through are having an onset less than 3 years of age. The pets are often indoor pets, but not exclusively. They often respond to glucocorticoids or cortisone, although we don't really want to rely on that for a long-term treatment. They often get yeast infections. Their front feet are typically affected, and they lick and chew at their front feet. Their flaps of their ears are often affected, but not the margins or the edges of the ear flaps, and they usually don't have lesions on the top of their rump, where the fleas typically are causing the problem. So that's kind of the list of criteria we go through.
You're right, because you know you have all these various signs. People want to know what's causing it. Sometimes you can't pinpoint one particular thing. I'll many times have clients come in going, oh yes, you know, I really think this is a food allergy. That's why it has this itchies, and now I have it on a grain-free diet. That seems to be the real linchpin right now of all of the various pet food advertisements. Ah, it's grain-free. What's the truth there? You're the expert on allergies. Are food allergies that common?
Food allergies are not nearly as common as I think people gather from wandering around in the pet store and looking at all the foods that are marketed in that fashion. So I find that only 5 or maybe 10% of pets that are itchy respond to a diet change in the end, whereas I think people get a much different impression from the pet stores or online looking at information they might find there. And the grain issue is, certainly I think overblown by some of the marketing of some of the pet food companies. It's really more often the protein sources that are the cause of the allergy. In any studies that have looked at what the causes of food allergy are, it's usually the protein sources.
With allergies, and I know when people come into me and I'll try and sit and take a good history from them, you know, is it, what age did it start? Is it a seasonal problem? And oftentimes, like here in Southern California, it's a year-round problem. What do you typically see with regard to seasonality and age of onset? You said around 3 years of age. Can it be younger?
Yeah, it can be younger and it can be older. That's just one of the criteria we look for, but often they have an onset of at least mild signs before 3 years of age. And it can turn from a seasonal problem that may only happen during the summer months, for instance, and turn into a year-round problem within several years to to the point where there may be still some seasonal change in the intensity of the itchiness, but they are affected then all year round. And that happens quite often, especially in Southern California.
With regard to you saying dust mites, and I know there is a manufacturer that talks about dust mites and how your mattress will gain 8 pounds or something crazy in a couple of years because of all these little dust mites are in there. How big are these things? Can you see them with the naked eye? And it's like, I'm not the best housekeeper, but you know, I don't think I've ever seen a little creature crawling around. What are they found in? What can you do to get rid of these guys? Because it sounds like it's almost impossible.
It's hard to eliminate them altogether. Homes with, you know, more carpeting are going to have more dust mites, but you're right, in certain bedding, dog beds can certainly contain a fair number of dust mites over time. So there are covers that are made for bedding and pillows to try and reduce dust mite exposure and accumulation. Changing the dog beds, washing dog bed covers, things like that can help reduce it. But they're really limited evidence that really shows that you can avoid dust mites enough to make dogs actually improve. So it's a challenge to actually remove enough dust mites from a home in order to be a clinical improvement in the pet.
You were talking about dog beds, you know. We're looking at some of these cedar-filled beds going, oh, it's going to smell so good. It's going to be great because it supposedly repels insects. Are they good or bad?
I don't think they're terribly good at repelling fleas, which is what I remember people always looking for a cedar bed for. There might be some effective essential oils on repelling insects to some degree, but I haven't found them to be terribly effective in a clinical way where the pets become less itchy.
Any problems associated with those aromatics being given off?
Those are hard to document, so really all we can do as clinicians is try and have people, if they suspect that or we suspect that, is remove the bed for a couple of weeks, see if there's an improvement or not. And it's not too often that I find that actually turns into a clinical improvement.
So if you want to get one of those beds, I guess go for it. Not a bad idea. One of the biggest problems that I will see, and people say, oh, it's just acting like a cat, a dog that is licking its paws. They think it is just a matter of grooming or a matter of walking on the grass, for instance, and getting itchy paws from that. Is a contact allergy that common, or would you say most dogs are going to be having this as a sign of atopic dermatitis, atopy?
Well, I think it is most commonly a sign of atopic dermatitis. I think there are certain dogs and maybe certain breeds in particular. I hear the same thing from owners of Bichons and Italian Greyhounds, some of those toy breeds that they claim with their feet as a habit. And maybe there's some truth to part of that, as long as they're not creating any lesions. But we now understand, I think, that atopic dermatitis, this whole allergy issue to grass pollens and such and mold spores, is really almost a contact sort of a process anyway. The allergens are actually absorbed across the skin, so they are exposed to those things more when they're walking around in the grass. But that's a little different than a true contact allergy that happens 2 days after you're in contact with something.
So atopy is contact. Is it also inhaled?
We don't think that inhalant exposure is a very significant part of atopic dermatitis any longer. It used to be taught that way, but...
I was going to say it. Wait a minute. I remember in veterinary school, that's what they taught us. I love it how things are changing.
Now we know that there's some defects in the epidermis of people with atopic eczema and also in dogs with atopic dermatitis that probably allows allergens to penetrate through the outer layer of skin, the epidermis, more easily.
So if this contact dermatitis, or not contact, is absorbed through the skin, can you then just bathe it off? Isn't that just a cure for it then? Bathe your dog every other day.
Yeah, some dogs do respond, or at least show some significant improvement when we bathe them more frequently with a general kind of moisturizing type of shampoo. And the thought is there that we can perhaps wash some of the allergens off before they penetrate through the skin. There's also a lot of interest in trying to help repair that epidermis. We call it the barrier function of the skin, to help repair that so that it functions more normally to keep the allergens out.
You were talking about a gentle shampoo. I know something that I used to recommend and now no longer do so. Correct me if I should go back to it. I used to tell people, boy, use a baby shampoo. If it was mild enough to use on a human baby, you should be able to use it on a baby. It's not going to hurt their eyes. It's going to be okay for their skin. And then I was told, not a good idea. Do you concur with that?
No, I guess I'm maybe more flexible about that than whoever told you might have been. So I don't tell people to stop using a baby shampoo if they've been using it for months and the pet is fine with it. But I recommend veterinary ones that I'm very familiar with rather than the typical baby shampoo from over-the-counter sources.
As I understand, again, what I was taught, see if it's changed, that the pH of a pet skin is very different than ours. Our shampoos are typically made for our hair, and a pet shampoo is basically made for their skin.
Well, that I remember those kind of claims as well, but I think what was found was actually the pH of the skin of a dog actually varies quite a bit from site to site and even maybe from hair coat type to hair coat type. So that's probably overstating it a little bit to say that the pH of human skin is drastically different than a dog's.
This is good. So see, everyone can always learn something. I learn something every time I chat with an expert. And thank you. This is very important for me. All right. So we can use a baby shampoo. Better to use a pet shampoo. People are very concerned that you can't bathe more than maybe once a month. And your response to that one?
Well, I think that's kind of a fallacy, too, that pets can't be bathed very often. As long as we're using a gentle shampoo, and sometimes even a medicated shampoo if they really need it, we can bathe them even every day if need be. We don't, of course, want to have to do that for the owner's sake to recommend it every day. That's a lot of effort. But once a week, twice a week sometimes is pretty common in my practice when the patients are itchy or have otherwise skin problems that we need to treat.
I actually have a client comes in 3 times a week to get her Australian Shepherd bathed because of an underlying skin condition, and it has made a major, major difference, just the bathing itself.
Yeah, we see that a lot.
All right, so we have these itchy pets chewing on our paws. One of the things I know that will sometimes happen with these atopic dogs is getting yeast infections. And people think, oh, wow, it has a vaginal yeast infection going. No, 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 not the same type of thing. I'd love to have you address yeast infections and how that can make a pet itchy too.
So most of the time, this yeast that is a normal inhabitant of the skin doesn't cause trouble, but in dogs that have allergies in particular and other conditions as well, but mostly in those with allergies, the skin is overgrown with this yeast, and they can in fact become allergic to some of the products that the yeast is creating. Some of the parts of the yeast organism can elicit an allergy, so then they almost are a cause of the allergy at that point as well. And so treating that yeast infection, diagnosing it accurately with what we call cytology, and treating it either with topicals or many times with a systemic antifungal drug are really important to get these allergic/yeast infections under control. So we get the infection under control. Sometimes the itchiness will go down 50 or 75% just by treating that, even without doing anything in particular for the allergy, because it can really aggravate the allergic condition.
All right. So I'm talking right now to Dr. John Plant, a board-certified veterinary dermatologist from Lake Oswego, Oregon, talking about allergies, all the various things that can cause it. We're going to take a short break. Come back to the way that veterinarians typically treat allergies and the way that Dr. Plant has come up with a very unique method of controlling them. We'll be right back.
Please have a seat in the waiting room. The doctor will be with you shortly, right after these messages.
Hi, this is Tim Link, animal communicator and pet expert, and host of Animal Rights on Pet Life Radio. Have you ever wanted to know what your pet is really thinking? Do you want to find out if they truly understand what you're trying to tell them? Ever wish you could build a better understanding and closer relationship with your pet? Well, now you can. Learning to communicate with animals is a 4-part on-demand workshop. In the workshop, you'll learn the essential techniques that are necessary to communicate with animals, including what is animal communication, breathing correctly to achieve the perfect state to communicate with your animals at a deeper level, using guided meditation exercises and method to communicate with animals, and how to send and receive information from your animals. So if you're wanting to learn how to communicate and connect with your animals at a deeper level, visit PetLifeRadio.com/workshop and purchase and download Learning to Communicate with Animals. You'll be glad you did.
Love My Pets, the new single by Mark Winter, available on iTunes.
Let's talk pets.
Let's talk pets
on Pet Life Radio.
Pet Life Radio.
PetLifeRadio.com.
Welcome back to The Pet Doctor on Pet Life Radio with Dr. Bernadine Cruz. The doctor is in and we'll see you now.
Dr. John, this is such an important subject, at least in these areas that have lots of allergic dogs and cats, not just Southern California where I am. I know one of the ways that veterinarians such as myself, being non-board certified, will oftentimes treat is using antihistamines, and you had mentioned earlier on using cortisone. What are the ill effects of using cortisone in pets long-term or high dose?
So, well, first let's clarify what cortisone is, because people call it by different things. Steroids is kind of a catch-all phrase. Cortisone is a type of a steroid, and a common example of a glucocorticoid or cortisone would be prednisone. So we're really talking about a glucocorticoid or prednisone or something equivalent to that. But now I've clarified that. What we're really concerned about are some changes that are almost predictable, certainly going to happen, like weight gain, increased drinking and urination. They are much more susceptible to cystitis or bladder infections with chronic cortisone, and also their liver enzymes are going to start rising and be a sign that they're depositing more fat in their liver and cells in their liver. So that doesn't necessarily result in clinical problems, but something that we would want to monitor for a pet that was taking cortisone. And they can get other problems as well that are less common, but maybe even more severe, like potentially putting a pet into diabetes that was already teetering on the edge of becoming diabetic, or perhaps even going into some depression or aggression, other kind of behavioral changes, things like that.
Weakening their joints, yes, all sorts of problems. And steroids used too long can also cause skin issues.
Right, and high doses of steroids can cause some of the most severe skin issues, aside from just losing hair, which is pretty common when they're on chronic cortisone. In a few cases, we see them actually forming calcium deposits in their skin called calcinosis cutis, which is a very hard problem to deal with because caused by the cortisone, it causes a lot of inflammation and itching, and there's really no great way to get rid of it other than just time if we're lucky.
In talking about skin and cortisone, I think a lot of people are very surprised, and I've seen this, thankfully, not that often, where in particular is a small dog, small cat. Somebody's gone to the pharmacy, picked up a cortisone cream, or they had one for their own selves. It was something their dermatologist recommended and thought, oh, we'll just put some of this over here. Oh, there's a lesion over here. And they pretty much just slather the pet all over with a cortisone cream. It's not itchy, but then all of a sudden it starts drinking a lot of water, start getting pot belly, start having the effects that we would think of with oral cortisone. And you ask the question going, oh no, I'm not giving any pills whatsoever. But it can get absorbed through the skin, can't it?
Yes, it does. All cortisone gets absorbed pretty well through the skin. And especially in those small pets that you mentioned, those are the ones that are most susceptible to getting systemic side effects from topical cortisone use, especially if you start doing it chronically.
So besides using antihistamines, using cortisone steroids to control itching, there are times when it's just not in the pet's best interest. They want to do something else. They want to cure allergies. Is there a way to cure these allergies?
the closest we can really come to curing allergies, and I don't use that term because I don't want to give a false impression that things are going to be 100% better with any treatment for allergies, but the closest we can come to dealing with the underlying problem is the process of immunotherapy, which also goes by the name desensitization or hyposensitization, and that's where we're trying to induce a state of tolerance to those things that are currently causing the allergy for the pet. So those pollens, mold spores, dust mites that are causing the allergy by the body overreacting to them, we hope to make the pet understand that these things are not ones that they should be overreacting to by giving them small amounts of those allergens. It's very similar to what somebody with hay fever might go through, what's often referred to as allergy shock.
When I was a child, I was very, very allergic. And I remember going to a dermatologist, and they put little pinpricks of these allergens underneath the skin of my back and then watched it, how it would swell up. And from the size of the wheel, the swelling, they were able to say, ah, you're allergic to this, you're not too allergic to that. And I never went through the desensitization. When I was in veterinary school, I was told that that was the gold standard, doing the skin allergy testing. And then it progressed from there into taking a blood sample and having that allergy tested. Talk a little bit about that background and what you've come up with, because it's really very different.
Yeah, so I did allergy testing for many years, and basically I think the body of evidence would show that even the intradermal testing, what you referred to as kind of the testing on the back there for yourself, the intradermal testing with little injections into the skin is not as perfect as a gold standard should be. We can get different results from the different dermatologists looking at the same pet, which shouldn't be the case for a gold standard. The blood tests are probably even worse in my mind. I've recently done a study where we submitted multiple blood samples from the same pets to different laboratories and got almost no overlap between the results of those, and we don't know if any of them are more accurate than another, but it just really makes me pause that we don't really have a way of telling a client exactly what their pet is allergic to. So my approach at this point is to desensitize to the most common allergens by the geographic region the pet is in, rather than telling the client that I can figure out exactly what their pet is allergic to. We will desensitize to the most common ones, partly because of what I just described as the inaccuracy of the testing, but also because there was a study that showed that even desensitizing to a group of the most common things in an area was just as effective as desensitizing to the customized extract based on an intradermal test result. So my approach I call regionally specific immunotherapy, or RESPIT, and it just makes sense to me that if we can't tell somebody exactly what their pet is allergic to, or even with great confidence what they're allergic to, that we shouldn't be recommending that they spend hundreds of dollars on that test. So I'm a little unique amongst veterinary dermatologists in making that recommendation, but that's kind of the point I've gotten to.
And it seems to make sense, because I know those times that I send in a blood sample and it's reported back, it's like, okay, it's allergic to everything. So desensitizing it to the most common things in an area makes sense. Looking at your brochure, how it breaks the United States down into various regions, I feel so special. California is in a region all by itself. What are some of the common allergens in various parts of the United States? How have you broken this up?
So I looked at data that's available from various allergen companies, as well as other websites and information that I could gather. Looked at the allergens that are considered most potent, most common in an area, and I included ones that do not cross-react with each other so much, because we believe that if we include one type of northern pasture grass, we don't necessarily need to include all of its close cousins. So that's how I've kind of chosen certain allergens amongst a group of very similar ones. And basically looked at as much information as I could gather and chose about 20 of the most common for each area, which pulled in a representative of many of the important allergen groups in the region. And, of course, one could break down the regions much smaller or much larger. My regions are similar to what some of the serum allergy testing companies offer when they're choosing which things to test for. One always has to sort of make a choice of how you're going to do something by region. where you draw the line. Sometimes it's very similar allergens for adjacent regions, and it probably just wouldn't make sense to break it down any further.
So now you've determined what a pet is sensitive to or most likely sensitive to. I know a real pushback when I told people, okay, I can do the blood test. Oh, that's fine. Take the blood sample. That's fine. And now you need to give injections to your pet at home, initially a couple times a week, and they look at me as like, next, I am not doing this. I cannot give my pet an injection. I see a needle and I faint. So how are you doing yours?
So I recommend, we have two options of administration available. One is the typical injection. That's the method that's been used for 50, 60 years in dogs and longer in people to administer allergens. I have a simplified schedule of just doing once a week injections, and many of my clients still do that. Occasionally I'll have somebody that comes in every week for the injection with their pet, but most people learn to do it themselves. But this spring we introduced another option, which is called oral mucosal administration. So this is a little spritz bottle that is sprayed into the cheek, a small volume. The idea is that it's absorbed across the mucosa of the mouth of the dog so that you don't need to do the injections. The disadvantage is that it needs to be done every day. And this this concept is based on the sublingual approach that is used in people under the tongue. And that's used quite commonly in Europe and is undergoing FDA testing in the United States too, to become more of a accepted approach in the U.S. for doing immunotherapy. So it's an interesting approach. It definitely avoids that the barrier people might have with needles and injections. I know I have friends that, you know, just really, like you described, cannot see the needle without fainting. And so this is a nice option for those people.
What is the onset of response? Of course, you know, you squirt it in the mouth and somebody wants it, the pet, to be better tomorrow. That's not going to happen. How long does it typically take the immune system to finally say, oh, seen that, been there, not a big deal?
So usually we're going to have to make sure that we make this clear from the beginning, of course, that it's this is a long-term treatment. That's how I present it to people. It's not a quick fix. If the pet is miserably itchy, you still need to do something at the start of the immunotherapy, something else that's going to be more effective in a shorter time frame. This is going to take often 3 to 6 months, as with injectable immunotherapy, and it kind of depends on the time of the year that we're starting it, too. If it's the summer that we're beginning immunotherapy and the pet is usually better in the winter, we may not have a true assessment until the next summer how effective it has been. So probably best if people are going to try immunotherapy of any sort to give it at least 1 year. And if they're improving at the end of a year or have improved greatly, then it's probably worth continuing for 3 years or so.
And what is the rate of improvement? What's the percentage of pets that improve using this immunotherapy?
About 2/3 of the patients will improve with immunotherapy. It's usually not a 100% improvement, as with people taking allergy shots. It's usually a matter of degrees, so that we are less uncomfortable and don't have to take as many other medications or other treatments to control the allergies. So, but about 2/3 are judged by owners to have improved good or excellent.
Now, we've been talking about dogs throughout this, but how about cats? They also have their skin issues.
Yes, cats are sometimes a little bit more difficult to treat, I would say, as far as their severity of their allergies. Oftentimes when they come to me, they have some pretty severe plaques, kind of those big red boggy lesions, and we got to really make sure that we've got the fleas under control in cats especially. But if they have flea allergy and food allergy ruled out and it looks like an allergic cat, then we can use immunotherapy on them as well. I often quote people a little bit lower response rate in cats. We have fewer studies to rely on, but I quote people about a 50% response rate with immunotherapy in cats.
That's still so much better than having his cats tear themselves apart.
Yes, definitely.
Well, Dr. Plant, this has been very interesting. I've learned a great deal from chatting with you. And one of the things I was always told in veterinary school, 10 years out, 50% of what you learned is going to be wrong. It's up to us to learn which 50%. So I'm constantly learning. And I hope our listeners today have also learned a lot about allergies. If people wanted to know more about your particular system, where can they go to get some information?
I have a website called vetrespite.com. that has a section for pet owners where they can learn more about respite. That's respite.com.
And respite is R-E-S-P-I-T, and that'll be on our website. So, Dr. Plant, thank you so much for being with us. I got a little bit of an itch here, so I'm going to have to stop this conversation and go scratch it. Thank you so much for listening today. This is Dr. Bernadine Cruz with A Pet Doctor. We'll be back next week. We'll have some more information on how to make you the best possible pet owner you can be. Thanks for listening.
Pets can be a wonderful addition to your life. Keeping them healthy and happy is important. Pet Life Radio presents The Pet Doctor with veterinary media consultant and veterinarian Dr. Bernadine Cruz. Whether you have a dog, cat, reptile, or rabbit, you'll find answers for your pets straight from the vets. The Pet Doctor, on demand every week, only on PetLifeRadio.com.